May it please the court, Mr. Timothy Lee and Mr. Douglas Matthews will present arguments to the petitioner. Will Mr. Timothy Lee open?
May it please the court. My name is Tim Lee. Co-counsel's name is Doug Matthews. Together we represent the petitioner, Haskell Mitchell, who was plaintiff at trial. This is a personal injury FELA case. It is a case that we are before this court complaining about errors which the trial court made in its instructions to the jury at trial. We are asking this court for a reversal of the decision of the Court of Appeals and a remand for a new trial. This case rose out of an incident which occurred on January 21, 1984. Plaintiff was a brakeman for the Missouri-Kansas-Texas Railroad, the Katy Railroad as it's usually referred to, and he started work in Denison, Texas. The ordinary custom and practice of the Katy Railroad was to pick up its crews at Denison, Texas by bringing a train through in an area called the Y. The Y is simply a situation in Denison where two railroad tracks come together, sort of forming a giant letter Y. Plaintiff started work on the morning of the 21st, 5:30 in the morning. As is typical for that part of Texas, it was cold and it was dark. It was more than just dark from lack of sunlight, because as the testimony showed, at the location where plaintiff had to board the train, the overhead light was out and the running lights on the train were out. The normal practice of the Katy in the Denison yard when crews were boarding was not to stop the train, but rather to merely slow it and have the crew get aboard the still moving train when crews were being changed off. This was essentially the situation that was occurring when plaintiff was injured. What happened is that plaintiff grabbed the grab irons and sill steps on the engine of the train that he was attempting to get on to begin to work. He got up one step onto that engine. Because it was dark, he didn't realize that the engine was covered with ice. Plaintiff slipped on the ice on the step mounting the engine, slid back down the grab iron, hit the ground, was dragged along by the train for some 10 or 15 feet. As a result of this accident, plaintiff received a severe back injury. I think it is 5 discs were affected. This man has probably the worst back that we have seen in our experience with railroad work in as long as the firm has been in existence. Plaintiff is completely disabled from his job as a brakeman. At the time of the trial, he was not working, and he, in fact, is still not working. We are before this court because of the manner in which the trial court instructed the jury in this FELA case. And it is of some significance the way that the instruction was included in the charge, because it is not a standard FELA type of instruction. In fact, again, in our experience, it is a unique instruction for the trial court to have given in this kind of case. This case was tried for about 2 weeks. At the end of 2 weeks of evidence in Fort Bend County, in front of Reagan Clark, who was the trial judge, an extensive charge conference was held. Possibly because this was the first time Judge Clark had ever tried an FELA case, the judge had a lot of questions about how such a case should be submitted. And we talked about it in chambers for the better part of Friday afternoon. The next Monday, when we came back to argue this case to the jury, the judge had decided, among other things, that he was going to submit the section of the charge that we are complaining of to this court. This was a charge that neither the Katy nor plaintiff had asked for with respect to the specific part we are complaining of. Rather, the judge had drafted it over the weekend and, somewhat to our surprise, presented it to us Monday morning as being the charge that was going to be delivered to the jury. Objections, of course, were properly made to the charge, and we have pursued our complaints to that section of the charge in front of this court. The specific part of this FELA charge that a plaintiff takes objection to is the instruction under the general negligence issue. That instruction is reproduced in the brief. It is basically a foreseeability or a knowledge or notice instruction. What it says is, in answering this issue, and it's referring to the negligence issue, you are instructed that before negligence, if any, can be established against the defendant railroad, the defendant railroad must be shown, through its officers, agents, and employees, to have known, or in the exercise of ordinary care, could have known, of an unsafe condition, if any. Our application for writ of error set out 3 points of error, and writ was granted on all three. In our time before the court today, we would like to concentrate on the third point of error that we have briefed in the application for writ of error. The third point of error, which we're concentrating on, frankly, because we think it most clearly demonstrates the harm or the vice of this type of instruction in an FELA, a statutory negligence case. The third point of error is that the case should be reversed and remanded because the instruction constituted a comment on the case and a comment on the weight of the evidence. Under Texas authorities such as Accord versus General Motors and the cases that this court has decided in that general line of cases. We have presented two other points of error in the application, and we will deal with them very briefly today in argument, but we really think that the central focus of the case, at least in our mind as we are thinking about it presently, is with respect to that third point of error. We contend the case should be reversed because this instruction was a comment on the case and a comment on the weight of the evidence, an Accord-type comment. Basically, there are two kinds of harm, or two reasons the plaintiff was harmed by this instruction. And whether it's labeled a foreseeability instruction or a knowledge or notice instruction makes no difference. The harm came about initially because of what the instruction said. The instruction did not just tilt the jury in favor of the defendant railroad, which is all that's required under a court. This instruction shoved the jury decidedly in favor of the defendant railroad. Under the Accord doctrine, that is reversible error. The second type of harm that this instruction presented, however, was because of what it did not say. The position that we are taking before the court is that while the instruction may be a correct partial statement of FELA law, it is not a complete statement of the rights, duties, and responsibilities that the federal statute places upon the railroad. Because it is incomplete, it was misleading to the jury and resulted in what we feel is the rendition of an improper verdict. The general doctrine that this court has set out for what constitutes a comment on the case and a comment on the weight of the evidence is found in the Accord case, in First International Bank of San Antonio versus Roper, and in Lemos versus Montez. The way that we read those cases, Texas procedural law now states that a case should be reversed if two things occur. First, if a jury is burdened by unnecessary instructions that are not required for the jury to decide an issue. And secondly, if the case is closely contested and the instructions nudge the jury in favor of one party or the other. It is our position that the petitioner's case clearly meets both of these standards and should be reversed on the basis of the Texas procedural law. The first area of harm or vice that this instruction caused was because of what it said. The language of the instruction is overtly one-sided. It applies to only one party. It told the jury, before you can find the railroad negligent, you must find the following. It only outlined this type of protection with regard to the railroad. It clearly favors the railroad and sets up a hurdle that plaintiff must overcome before plaintiff can get to the jury on the negligence issue. It additionally, because of the way it's worded, basically instructs the jury to consider this issue first. Before negligence can be found, you must find so and such and such. Our position is that that type of language is certainly more one-sided. That type of language certainly inclines to the defendant much more than the type of language which has been held to be reversible error by this court in, for instance, the Accord case. The court will recall that the instruction in the Accord case was simply a statement that a manufacturer is not an insurer of its product. By the same token, the instruction that was found...
That's kind of a gratuitous comment. It's like a jury argument or worse, put in the charge. The Accord situation, don't you agree?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's nothing you have to consider in order to reach the result of the case. You say that this is a partially correct statement of the law.
That is
correct. It is correct, but it leaves some other things out.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So it seems to me this is different than a judge throwing in some useless and potentially misleading information into a charge.
Judge, I would agree with you partially. It is different. It is different insofar as it is worse. It is worse because it misleads the jury.
Well, I'm anxious. I know you have an argument planned out and you'll get there, but I'm anxious for you to just tell us what what this would have needed to say in order to be a correct statement. And then you may, convince us that it shouldn't have been said at all because it was covered elsewhere in the
trial,
Judge.
Certainly. A correct abstract statement of FELA law with regard to defective equipment, defective premises, either hidden or open and obvious kinds of defects, would state that the railroad has to have some type of knowledge or notice. It would also state that the railroad has a duty to virtually continuously inspect for defects on any equipment, on any railroad cars, engines, and on any premises where its employees are going to go. The complete statement of the responsibilities that are put upon the railroad by the FELA can be found in a case that the Cady cites in their briefs. That is the U.S. Supreme Court case of Schenker versus the B&O Railroad. That case was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1963. It was one of the last FELA cases, that the Supreme Court decided for approximately 20 or 25 years. What the Schenker case does is approve an instruction that is somewhat similar to the instruction that Judge Clark gave in part. But the instruction goes on to fully state the law with regard to FELA responsibilities. The instruction in that case, in the Schenker case, said that a railroad is under a duty to exercise ordinary prudence, caution, and care to inspect and to furnish its employees with cars on which they are equipped with reasonably safe doors. It was a railroad car door problem, even though the cars are owned by another railroad. The trial court in Schenker then went on to instruct concerning knowledge or notice. And that, we think, is an accurate statement in the abstract of the complete duties the FELA puts on a railroad with regard to premises defects.
Why isn't the second paragraph adequate, where it talks about the duty the railroad to provide a reasonable and safe place to work? Why isn't that what you're talking about?
Because the railroad, under the FELA, Judge Gonzalez, the railroad does not just have an ordinary common law kind of duty of an employer to an employee to provide a safe place to work. Railroad has an affirmative duty to go out and inspect wherever its employees are going to be for hazards. Under the FELA, a railroad worker is entitled to rely on being given a safe workplace, and it is important with regard to this case, because in this case, the Cady contended vigorously to the jury that they didn't know that there was ice on this train. And they may not have. But the reason they did not know that is because no inspection was made of this train before it slowed down at Denison to pick up crew.
If I understand your argument, you would impose a duty on a railroad on a cold, rainy day where there's obviously ice to suspend all operations on the train on all of its cars where employees may mount, to make sure that there is no ice or snow or they're wet. Is that your argument?
Judge, that's what the FELA requires. And if the railroad cannot do that, then it should not let its employees board those trains. And if the railroad lets its employees board those trains, Without making such an inspection, the FBLA says that it will be held responsible should they be hurt.
Counselor, let me just try to understand, you know, what all this means. Weather being what it is and changing often depending on wind patterns, etc., would it not be almost impossible burden to ensure that this rain has not formed into ice, or the ice has not become slush to become so slippery that there will be no operations on that type of a day? I mean, I'm just trying to understand, you know, how far we're going to carry this duty to inspect, to ensure that there will be, quote, no accident. I mean, it will be a problem-free environment.
Judge, I think the answer to your question can be seen in the Schenker case. Now, the Schenker case is not a weather case, I will grant you, but it is a case where the B&O Railroad had virtually no time to inspect the car that the petitioner in Schenker was injured on, despite the fact that the B&O had virtually no time to make that inspection. The Supreme Court upheld that finding of liability. In fact, in the dissent in Schenker, Justice Goldberg of the U.S. Supreme Court says that what the court has done is basically place a duty on the railroad not just to inspect, but to inspect and find all defects, regardless of the amount of time. In the context of inclement weather, the railroad has the responsibility under the statute to provide a reasonably safe place to work. That includes engines that do not have ice on the stair steps and the grab lines. If the railroad has to cease operations in order to do that, and now, Judge, we don't think that that's necessary to do in Denison, Texas, and there was evidence in this trial that an inspection could have been done. It just wasn't. But if that is what is required, then yes, Your Honor, that's what the statute, that's the responsibility that the statute places on the railroad.
Sir, you mentioned you spent a Friday afternoon in conference with the trial court judge discussing the charge. Did you submit a proposed definition and instruction that you wanted to be included?
Yes, Your Honor. We submitted the instructions, some of which actually made it into the charge. Our position before Judge Clark is the same position that we are taking before this court, and that is that the specific instruction we are complaining about should not have been submitted at all. That
is this continuing and non-delegable duty? Was that part of what you thought should be in the charge?
Yes. Yes. But to further answer your question, Justice Culver, our position then is as it remains presently, and that is this instruction should not have gone to the jury. It did go to the jury, and it is not even a correct, complete statement of the law. The effect of the instruction is to cut the heart out of the FBLA, because it sets up a precondition that the jury has to find in order to find the railroad negligent, but it does not tell the jury that the railroad has this very extensive duty to inspect that goes above and beyond what the common law replaced. It essentially makes the railroad liable in the same fashion that an ordinary premises owner would be liable. And the Katy Railroad is not treated by the FBLA the same way that Kroger Supermarket is treated by Texas common law. Now, the position that the Katy has taken before this court is arguing that that is not the case, that the duties are exactly the same. But we think cases such as the Schenker case clearly demonstrate that it isn't anything at all the same. Kroger Supermarket does not have the kind of duty that the FBLA puts on the Katy Railroad to go out and to inspect and to make sure wherever its employees go, whether they own the premises or not, whether they have control over the equipment or not, to make sure that that is a safe workplace.
And Mr. Lee, to what extent, if any, do federal court decisions impact instructions that are given
as this court recognized in Scott versus Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, in FBLA cases that are brought in Texas court, Texas procedural law governs the procedure. In Texas, we submit the charge the way that we normally would in an FBLA case, unless, for some reason, Texas procedure burdens one of the parties' substantive rights under the FBLA.
All right, now is it a substantive right under the FBLA that foreseeability is not an element?
Foreseeability is a component of an FELA case in Texas. It is a component of the issue of duty. In Texas, the duty issue is not submitted to the jury. The jury is not instructed on duty. Rather, the judge decides duty as a question of law. Since there is a fact finder deciding the duty question, then there's no compromise of the railroad's rights. It's the same with regard to the plaintiff, because the judge decides whatever standards the plaintiff will be held to with regard to his duty to avoid contributory negligence. There's no, in the same way as occurred in Scott versus Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, the Texas procedural law doesn't burden the substantive rights of the parties.
You say that the instruction given was a comment on the case and a comment on the weight. Really, all this instruction is an ordinary instruction on foreseeability. The railroad knew or should have known?
Yes.
And what do you say is defective about it?
Because in an FELA case, the jury shouldn't be instructed as to foreseeability. It would perhaps be appropriate in a common law premises
case.
What's
the case cite on that? That in an FELA case, the jury should not be instructed on foreseeability?
We can see that from the decision of the Eastland Court of Appeals called Standard, again, I think it's versus the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe. The Standard case holds that it is error to instruct the jury in an FELA case on foreseeability with respect to causation. The Standard case holds that the jury should not be instructed in Texas, period, with respect to foreseeability on duty. The Standard case was refused no reversible error by this court on the specific issue that is in front of that this case presents to the court. The disposition of Standard by this case indicates that this court, at least at that time, did not feel that it was appropriate to instruct the jury on foreseeability in an FELA case.
Does the Rogers court case say that in this Supreme Court case? Can we infer that? Of course, I know that that's based on a more general charge.
The Rogers case is initially not an instructions case.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What Rogers does in current FELA law is establishes the standard of, our position is that Rogers establishes the standard of causation to be applied in FELA cases. Rogers tells us that you make a case that is submissible to a jury as long as you've shown that the negligence of any party, in whole or in part, however slight, caused the damages. The Rogers case, we don't feel, tells you anything directly about what a jury should be instructed. It just establishes the standard of causation. The standard of causation is one of the significant differences between the statutory negligence action, the FELA, and the common law negligence action. However, in contrast with the Cady, plaintiff contends that there are other very significant distinctions between the FELA and common law negligence actions, one of them being the duty that Schenker establishes, and that is the duty to virtually continuously inspect wherever railroad employees are going to. Basically then, with respect to the instruction being a comment on the weight of the evidence, it is our position that the instruction was unnecessary. We see that from Standard. The instruction was inaccurate and misled the jury, and you can see that from the Schenker case. It is possibly a partially correct abstract statement of the law, but it is not a full statement of the law. And finally, the instruction is one-sided because it clearly favors the railroad, and it clearly sets up a barrier for the jury to find for the plaintiff.
You think if something like this were given, it should be up in the same paragraph with the continuing and non-delegable duty?
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't understand your question.
Well, there's some language that seems to more tilt towards the plaintiff in the preceding paragraph of the rather long instruction. Is part of your problem with the placement of it down there, right next to the answer? Or
Judge, it is not so much the placement as the wording of it. And it doesn't matter where that instruction is placed. If a jury is actually trying to follow the charge, they will consider that matter first, or at least it's logical that they would consider it first, because the instruction says before you can find negligence, you've got to find foreseeability or knowledge and notice. The placement is not what we are complaining of, though.
I have one other question now. Part of what we have to find here was closely contested case, harmful error. How long, it was a two-week trial, that's one of the indicia of that. How long was the jury out? Is that in the record? Probably is.
From my memory, the jury was out for a couple of hours. It should be in the record.
It should be stamped twice.
But I've never looked to see that it in fact is. The case was tried for 2 weeks. It was contested on virtually every issue. Liability was a hard-fought contest. It was a case that was submitted both on ordinary FVLA negligence and on a Boiler Inspection Act violation, which is a strict liability type of statute, and there was evidence, opposing evidence on all of those issues, and it's not completely clear from a court how much further one has to go to establish a closely contested case, except this one does seem to have all of the indicia, and certainly if the court looks at the final arguments of the party, the court can see that this particular issue and this particular instruction was closely contested because counsel for the Katie refers to it extensively and urges the jury to carefully consider this when deciding the liability issue. And that, we would submit, satisfies the requirements for a closely contested case.
Counsel, I've got a question. Sorry.
Certainly.
I've understood you to say that you believe it was an unnecessary comment on the weight of the evidence, or on the evidence, to have included this paragraph on before negligence you must find. I've understood your argument to be here that it should not have been given, but if it had been given, it was incomplete. Is that correct?
That's not precisely what we're saying, Judge. What we are saying is initially it shouldn't be given.
I understand that part. What's the second part?
That it is not a complete statement of the law.
Isn't that what I just said?
In the abstract, but we do not feel that under any circumstances this type of instruction in Texas should be given in an FVLA case. Right. Now, Judge, if I've just told you what you told me, then I misunderstood you.
Okay, let me ask you then a more pointed question. What would you have had the trial judge, assuming he were going to give this, and he was recalcitrant, would not change his mind, what would you have had him add to this instruction to make it pure?
You can't do that, Judge. It's still going to be a comment on the evidence and on the case, even if it is a correct statement of the law. You can make it a correct statement of FVLA law in the abstract if you tack something on to the effect of you are instructed that the railroad has a continuing duty to inspect for hazards or defects any place that its employees, such as plaintiff, are required to work, or something to that effect would make it a proper statement of the law. It would still be a comment on the weight, though.
I'm having difficulty figuring out what the comment is. It says before you can find a negligence, you've got to find that they knew or should have known of the unsafe condition. Wouldn't the duty to inspect be related to, at least, if not incorporated in, the should have known of an unsafe condition?
Certainly. Certainly, Judge. And what is different
then
about...
Then where's the vice? I'm not following.
What is different about the FVLA is the responsibility that it places on the railroad to inspect. The railroad has to inspect. Has to inspect virtually continuously. And if you are going to be discussing the FVLA law with respect to knowledge or foreseeability or notice, it is our position that you also need to be considering the fact that the railroad has a continuing duty to go out and find out what potential hazards there are.
I guess the essence of my question is that within the should have known part of the question?
Yes, Judge.
Then why is it a comment on the way that it is?
Because it wasn't submitted to the jury. The jury was not instructed that the railroad, there is a difference between having the responsibility to know that an ordinary premises owner has with reasonable behavior and the responsibility that the railroad has, which is to continuously inspect, find out hazards.
I'm just not seeing the difference between a duty to continuously inspect and a should have known of an unsafe condition.
And I guess I'm just not focusing on the question correctly, Judge. Let me just say one more thing. We would not contend that a Kroger supermarket has the kind of duty to go and look before its employees go anywhere in that supermarket on a continuous basis, as occurs in the FBLA. We would not think that the Schenker kind of situation, where virtually no time passed between the hazard and the injury, would result in liability to Kroger Supermarket, but it will under the FBLA, because the railroad has that kind of continuing and continuous intensive scrutiny, intensive inspection type of duty.
So you would say that that whole charge had to be revamped in order to make it correct. Now, if you were writing the charge yourself, what would you say differently than what was said? And actually submit. I think that's what Judge Spears is getting at.
We take the same position we did at trial, Judge. That is, that this instruction on foreseeability or knowledge or notice shouldn't be submitted at all. That it's error to submit it at all.
Would you do it without any instructions or just without that last paragraph? I mean, would you just say call us however slight?
I don't think I understand.
Perfect charge, would you submit everything except that last paragraph? Or would you...
I think the answer to that question is no, but in my perfect
some
charge...
Some of it's requested by you defensively, I guess, is the question.
Yes. Yes, and while we're not really prepared...
That on rebuttal, maybe.
Yeah.
Prepared to discuss those, the other duty kinds of instructions.
On occasion, this court has taken an opportunity like this, certainly, like in Mobile Chemical versus Bell and in Hopkins and some of the others, to say what a charge should be and put it in the opinion so that other litigants don't have to spend their time and money coming up here. So, one thing I'd be interested in is how this should be submitted. I mean, we've heard a lot of complaints through the years that FBLA maybe should be put in state pattern jury charges and such. And there is some uncertainty in this area, and part of what our court exists about is try to settle questions if we can.
Initially,
but anyway, you don't have to answer that.
Okay.
You have to manage the problem. Any further questions? Thank you. We are ready to hear argument from response.
May it please the court, Mr. Brock Eggers and Mr. Jay Brinson will present arguments for the respondent. Mr. Eggers will.
May it please the court, I'm Brock Akers, along with Gabe Brinson. We represent the Katy Railroad in this case. We are going to demonstrate that the Court of Appeals was correct to uphold the trial court's instruction for two fundamental reasons. Number one, the instruction was a correct statement of law. And number two, the instruction is not extraneous in a comment, but is instead an essential element of this sort of a case when a case is to be submitted in an FBLA case to a jury such as this one. The instruction at issue obviously tells the jury that the railroad could only be negligent for a defective condition when the railroad has knowledge or notice of that condition. We have cited to the court a string of United States Supreme Court cases, Fifth Circuit cases, Sixth Circuit cases, Seventh Circuit cases, each and every one of which stands for the proposition that knowledge or notice is a prerequisite in a defective condition case. Now, the reason for that is quite simple. And the reason is because a railroad is not an insurer for its employees. In order for a plaintiff to prevail in an FBLA cause of action, there has to be demonstrated some fault on the part of the railroad, some causation with regard to the negligence of the railroad in order for the injured employee to recover. What petitioners would argue to this court is just the opposite, that in cases such as this, it is simply a matter of whether or not the act occurred. Because if you strike away and take away from the railroad the opportunity to limit the jury's consideration to those things which it knows about, or in the exercise of ordinary care should know about, then the railroad never has the opportunity to ever correct these problems, and the railroad can be held liable in instances when it, frankly, just plain has no negligence. Petitioner says that we have only one case. Well, they've miscounted, because we have several cases that stand for this proposition. and they're all adequately laid out in the brief. Petitioner cited one case for the court, one case only, for the proposition that notice is not a prerequisite. We need to look at that case. That's the Williams case. That's a case where a railroad worker was being required to work in water, in about waist-deep water, at night with a railroad crew with his foreman right next to him. In that case, the trial court, in error, instructed the jury that in order for the railroad to be found negligent, the railroad had to have notice from the employee himself, the fellow that died, that he was working under some dangerous condition. Now, the court held that that was too onerous a burden to place on an injured employee, and that makes sense, because, among other reasons, his foreman was right next to him, and certainly his foreman, as a vice principal of the railroad in that case, could understand the dangerous condition in which he was working. But that's not what we have here. We do not have a situation where we are asking for notice from Haskell Mitchell. Instead, this is a case where the railroad has to have notice from some source, or constructive notice, an opportunity to find the defect, the ice on the train, in order to correct it. Because as Justice Gonzalez points out in this questioning, otherwise the railroad just couldn't function. Otherwise, if you're going to impose an obligation on the railroad to have a completely defect-free instrumentality within which for the employees to work without any notice of them, they, we again have this situation where the railroad is the insurer, because the only way that the railroad can logically be negligent is if they have had some opportunity to correct the defect. In this case, they did not have the opportunity to correct the defect, apparently, because the jury found against Mr. Mitchell.
Counsel, let me ask you this, because maybe I have a misapprehension of whatever the LA law is. I'd always thought that if an accident occurred, and you could show that the railroad did not expect, and it was almost presumed that they were negligent.
I wouldn't disagree with that, Judge. And that's just another way of going about the same issue. If they didn't inspect, and that's what Schenker talks about, that they have the duty to inspect, that they have the duty to find defects if they're there, but they have to have the opportunity to inspect. They have to have the opportunity to discover, because just the failure to inspect is not itself going to be negligence unless there is also an opportunity for that inspection to do some good for them, unless there's some opportunity for them to correct that defect.
All right, under the facts of this case, tell me how it is that the railroad is not liable under what I've just said.
The ice was present, as the jury found, on the train. But the ice had to have developed in some very short period of time while the train was moving. They did not have the opportunity between the time that the train was last inspected and the time that this accident allegedly occurred to have notice of the presence of the ice. We don't know if that ice was there for 5 minutes, 5 seconds. That just isn't present. We know. And I didn't try the case, so I don't know. I can't cite with any specificity, maybe Mr. Brinson can, the amount of time between the time that the train was last inspected and the time that the accident occurred. But it is that time within which the jury has the opportunity to determine whether or not that A, had actual constructive knowledge about it, and B, had therefore the opportunity to do something about the problem. Without it, they just can't be negligent. Petitioner has not been able to cite to this court a single case, not one, that would stand for the proposition that the railroad can be found negligent when they do not have an opportunity to find a defect, the knowledge or notice. Mr. Lee mentioned that this was not a correct statement of law, and for that reason, not a complete statement of law, and for that reason, the charge is incomplete and fatally defective. Well, number one, that is an argument which was not raised in the trial court. There is no objection. There is no instruction that has been submitted to the court in lieu of the instruction that was ultimately given, which...
Let me understand. You're saying there was no objection to this charge?
No, there was... There were objections, and the objections were there was a comment on the evidence that injects foreseeability into the evidence. So those objections were present. But there wasn't, and I mistaken myself, there wasn't an alternative instruction to this one that was submitted to the court's consideration. That's why Judge Warren below, one of the reasons why the court affirmed, so they waived that point.
Let me ask you, are you contending that if an instruction is faulty, that you not only have to object to it, but you have to tender one in a substantially correct verb?
Yes, sir.
Even though you feel that no instruction at all is necessary?
Well, that obviously is the situation where that would not be true if the instruction itself shouldn't come in the court. I suspect that the plaintiff ought not have to redefine some instruction about a product manufacturer being insurer of product. In this case, however, this isn't an accord type case. This isn't the extraneous type jury argument type instruction that a judge might give. Instead, in this case, this is a fundamental element of the cause of action. Another thing, with regard to the argument that this isn't a complete statement, is the fact that if the complaint is that in order to make this a complete statement of law, we have to also impose upon the railroad and instruct about the railroad's duty to inspect, as Justice Spears inquired, I'm not sure that there's any difference between a requirement to discover, a requirement about knowledge or constructive knowledge, or a duty to inspect. I think that those are semantical differences only, because one acts the same as the other. If you...
Why are we arguing this? If the complaint is that the instruction is not complete, error has been laid by failure to tender a proper instruction, hasn't it?
Yes, sir. Then I'll go on. We next turn to the question of whether this is a correct statement of law. Petitioner wants to call this instruction one about foreseeability, saying that foreseeability is improper in this case because it injects proximate cause. Of course, the word foreseeability does not appear in this instruction. What it talks about is knowledge or notice, just like the Court of Appeals says. This is an instruction about knowledge or notice. But if this knowledge or notice instruction is tantamount to an instruction about foreseeability, that's okay too, because foreseeability is an essential ingredient of any FELA cause of action. And that, again, is something that is undeniable by petitioners. The Supreme Court cases that we cited are legion for the proposition that foreseeability is an element, and that the foreseeability of the harm is something that is clearly and totally within the jury's discretion. Now, foreseeability is not synonymous with the word proximate cause. Foreseeability is an element of proximate cause, but it is not the same thing. In this context, if indeed this knowledge or notice instruction is a foreseeability instruction, it can only be one that relates to the duty aspect of foreseeability. Because as the standard court points out, there are two areas in the tort type analysis wherein foreseeability plays part. First is in the duty, and second is in proximate cause. Now what standard says that by the way, the issue in standard of the Eastern Court was a proximate cause submission, which included the element of foreseeability, and the court held that it was proper for the trial court not to submit that. But what standard says, essentially, is that when we're talking about foreseeability in the duty context,
it's improper for the jury to decide what duty is. And we agree with that, of course, that makes sense. But what a trial court has to do when he is performing his proper function is
to define
the parameters of the jury
of that
duty so that the jury can make a decision.
And that's exactly what we have in this case.
The
jury was given the parameters within which
because to the extent that it is a correct statement of law, the only way that the railroad can become liable is if they had knowledge or notice. And if we do not instruct the jury about the knowledge or notice requirement, then the jury is permitted, and obviously is permitted to consider the negligence of the railroad without reference to the knowledge or notice of the defective condition. This isn't a crime. This isn't extraneous. This is something that is fundamentally necessary for the jury's consideration of what the scope of the duty of the railroad is. Without it, we would have been entitled to... We certainly wouldn't be objecting because of the fact that the jury would be potentially considering something which would be improper. Now, again, going to the petitioner's argument, all of the cases that they talk about dealing with foreseeability as it relates to proximate cause, and as I mentioned, I don't think they have any instance. With regard to the question of the instructions between federal law and state law, this is the absolute point that the railroad has in this case to have its negligence defined according to the true parameters of the case. A substantive right to have this instruction. To that extent, all of the many cases that we have cited before claim instructions of this nature, one with
it is not a comment, and this court should affirm the court below. Mr. Brinson will have further arguments.
If the court please, I'll be brief and hopefully not repetitious. Mr. Justice Ray, you addressed a question to Mr. Akers, which I'll attempt to respond to. There was no evidence of any kind, no direct evidence, that there was, in fact, ice on this locomotive at the time of this accident. The evidence of ice came from the crewmen who observed, as they put it, ice all over the locomotive the following morning when it got to be daylight. We must presume that the jury concluded circumstantially that there was ice on the locomotive. For my part, when I argued this case, I didn't take the position with the jury that there was no ice there. From the evidence, I thought it was probably likely that there was, and to at least preserve my credibility, I didn't take the opposite position. However, we would submit to the court that there was absolutely no evidence when the ice formed. And the problem is that the railroad, I think clearly under the law, is not an insurer for the safety of these men. And unless the jury is instructed as to the railroad's duty in that regard, the railroad is in fact made an insurer. Unless the railroad either knows or should have known that there was ice on this locomotive at the time, it has no opportunity to do anything about it, and consequently would, in fact, be an insurer. This is a transitory condition, court please. If we were talking, for example, about a...
No, or should have known doesn't stand alone, though. I mean, we use that in ordinary charge and say, should a reasonable person know or should have known? That's your ordinary charge. The railroad is held to some slightly different burden under this statute, is it not? And is that laid out in the charge, what that different burden is? It says a continuing and non-delegable duty to provide for the safety. I believe that's in the charge.
That's precisely.
Is that enough, then?
Yes, Your Honor, and the jury was so instructed as to the railroad's duty in that regard. Now the appellants complain here that the jury should not be instructed as to the railroad's duty. We would submit to the court that this is just another instruction as to the railroad's duty, and I would remind the court that negligence is negligence. In this charge, the jury was instructed as to what an ordinarily prudent person would do under the same or similar circumstances, just as a jury would be instructed on a slip and fall case in Weingarten, what an ordinarily prudent person would do under the same circumstances.
Counsel, let me ask you a question to try to clarify this in my mind. If I understand it, your argument is that the foreseeability is required not as a part of a proximate cause issue, let's say, in an ordinary case, but as part of the duty requirement.
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly. Precisely. Nothing was said about foreseeability with regard to cause. I don't think that the
you're saying it must be foreseeable in order for there to be a duty.
Exactly. If
not what, it doesn't have anything to do with what caused or did not cause the accident.
Exactly.
I'm beginning to understand. Thank you.
Exactly.
What is your concept of foreseeability? It's a hybrid somewhere between negligence and proximate causation.
Well, Judge, I think there are two aspects to it. You're talking about foreseeability as we think about it in terms of proximate cause. That's one thing. If you think about foreseeability with regard to duty, that's something else. And I don't think the railroad, after all, has to be found negligent before they are liable in a case like this, absent some strict liability finding, such as the Boiler Inspection Act, which is something else I'll come to. The plaintiff has the same burden to get a negligence finding against the railroad in an FELA case as they would against anybody else in a negligence case. Again, negligence is negligence. It's a failure to use ordinary care. How can you use ordinary care to correct conditions that you couldn't know of? A transitory condition. That's really the key to it. We would submit to the court. There are two reasons I would submit why the jury didn't find the railroad negligent. First of all, there was considerable evidence that these men work in all kinds of weather. They work when it's wet, they work when it's dry, they work when it's cold and freezing, and they work in the dark. It's a matter of common knowledge, I believe, that in the northern regions of this country, it probably freezes in October and doesn't thaw out until April. Consequently, there's nothing unsafe or hazardous necessarily about a switchman boarding a moving train at night. This man had a ladder. They do it all the time. It's part of the job. And I believe the jury believed that. Moreover, the special issue number two, question number two today, was the Boiler Inspection Act charge. And the jury found, in response to that, that the steps were not in improper condition and not unsafe. Now, on the first issue, they found that there was ice on the steps. In the second issue, the strict liability issue, the boiler inspection issue, they found that the steps were not unsafe.
Counsel, did they find the steps were not unsafe, or that the railroad did not create an unsafe condition? Which was it?
Well, court, please, I don't have the charge. All I have is my notes.
Might make a difference. I don't think it's crucial.
The question is, were the steps, platform, and or grab irons of the engine in question in an improper condition and unsafe to operate as a result of the ice thereon? at the time, plaintiff attempted to board the engine. They found, they answered that no. That is to say that they were not in an improper condition and unsafe to operate. After that finding, we would submit that it's not surprising that the jury found that the railroad was not negligent. And I might say to the court, this was an ICE case. That's the way the case was tried. With regard to the instruction itself, when I got up and spoke to the jury on opening argument, opening statement, as the appellant has cited in his brief, I told these folks that one of the contested questions in the case would be whether or not there was ice on the steps and whether or not the railroad knew or could have known that there was ice. I submitted the charge. I would much have preferred a question that asked if there was ice on the steps, and if it had been, number two, had it been there long enough so the railroad could have known about it, and number three, were they negligent for not doing something about it. Now, we argued about it at great length. The instruction and the request for instruction came from the defendant before the trial.
Both you and Mr. Lee have at one point in your argument today said knew or could have known. What I have written here is knew or should have known. It was knew or should have known.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Could is a whole lot different and I just thought Mr. Lee probably misread them when you said it too.
Well, I'm not reading, of course, please. I'm trying to remember. But that's exactly right. It was should have known. One other point I would like to make, and then I think set it up. In the objections to the charge made by the plaintiff in the trial court, and I paraphrase this, and I hope correctly, and Mr. Lee said that this instruction was prejudicial because it injects foreseeability into an FELA case. Well, we've covered that. I think the court will find in our brief a legion of cases by the Supreme Court of the United States that say that it's proper to instruct the jury on foreseeability. Number two, he says it's a comment on the evidence because it's not proper for a jury to consider in an FELA case, and it's unnecessary and surplus and therefore a comment on the evidence. Thirdly, he said if the court gives that instruction to the defendant, then the plaintiff ought to be entitled to one. It's been mentioned here, but I probably bear repeating, no instruction was requested by the plaintiff in the trial court with regard to the plaintiff's duty, and of course there was no instruction or no request for any further instruction. And that, if the court please, is the sum and substance of the plaintiff's objections to the charge. And a fair reading of it, we would submit, is that the only objection really that the only valid objection that the plaintiff made in the trial court is that the general objection that this instruction is a comment on the evidence. And we would submit that not only was it not a comment on the evidence, but it was an essential part of the court's charge. Counsel's suggestion that they've never seen anything like this, I find quite strange. I represented the Key Railroad for almost 25 years, and I've tried lots and lots and lots of these cases. I submit that the reason that you don't see this instruction is that only very, very seldom is the court presented with a transitory condition. There's no question that had this been a broken rail case, let's say, where the railroad has a duty to go out and inspect its equipment. And in fact, there is a case, I believe it's in our brief, involving some old worn-out rails. The rail broke, the train derailed, somebody got hurt. Under those conditions, unquestionably, the railroad has a continuing and non-delegable duty to make an inspection and would be charged with knowledge or notice. Such is not the condition we submit to the court with regard to something as transitory as ice in the wintertime.
Thank you.
Thank you, court.
Please the court. I'm not going to tell the court how many FBLA cases I've tried or for how many years I've been doing it, but Mr. Brunson and I have seen each other once or twice on these cases, and we both have some experience in this area. It is always a problem in presenting an FBLA case, whether it's at the trial court level or at the appellate court level, in the state courts, for the court to have a full appreciation of what we're dealing with. We are dealing with what has been said to be, by the commentators, the most progressive, the most far-reaching law dealing with compensation for injuries to individuals in any jurisdiction, in any country, anywhere, ever adopted. It is nothing like ordinary common law kinds of cases. It doesn't even come close to them. It is difficult sometimes to convey that principle and to understand how it is different unless one looks at the cases. With the indulgence of the court, I want to read one quotation from the Schieffer case that bears on some of the questions that have been asked by the court here this morning. And this deals with the duty to inspect and the fact that we're dealing with how does the railroad acquire knowledge of defects and when does the railroad become responsible for such conditions like ice, or in the Schieffer case, a railroad employee was going over to do some work on a train owned by another railroad that pulled into a station and stopped for just a few minutes and then pulled out. And the railroad had no time to go inspect that train. And here's what the Supreme Court of the United States said. This is the dissent characterizing the holding of the majority. On page 1675 of Schieffer, which is 374 U.S. 14, under the rationale and result of this case, a railroad would be liable for a defect which first appeared immediately prior to the injury for which recovery is sought, and which even the most scrupulous kind of inspection procedure could neither have avoided nor detected. What the court appears to have done is to create not simply a duty of inspection, but an absolute duty of discovery of all defects. And I suggest to the court that that is precisely the case. As far-reaching as that
sounds. I understand it correctly. You're reading it from the dissent?
That's the dissent characterizing what the majority has done.
Well, why don't you read what the majority has done? Because I think that's what you got is most of
the more than happy to, Your Honor. The dissent is a little upset about what the majority is saying about this statute. And let me just say, Justice Gonzalez, that one of the reasons for this statute is that when it was adopted, the average life expectancy of a brakeman was 7 years, and one out of every four switchmen was injured. And this statute was adopted in an effort to try to get railroads to basically clean up their act. It is more severe for the reason that it is trying to encourage, by far-reaching measures, improvements in safety. The majority, in describing the duty to inspect, on page 1673 says, the B&O required the petitioner, the B&O is the railroad in question, to work with cars belonging to the P&LE, that's the railroad whose cars pulled in for a few minutes, taking no precautions whatsoever to protect him from possible defects in these cars, defects from which it would be liable should they appear in its own cars. As Texas and Pacific makes abundantly clear, and what they're referring to there is a case involving Texas and Pacific, which they cited earlier, there is no de minimis rule called into play on account of the brevity of the sojourn, that is, the length of time, the stop, of the PNLE train in the Mohammedantown station, since the length of the sojourn is irrelevant to the duty owed to the employee working with the car. So basically, what counsel for respondent have been arguing here, that the railroad needs an opportunity to inspect, needs an opportunity to correct the defects, and it's the same kind of responsibility and rights which, let's say, Kmart has.
What was the defect in that case, in Schenker case? Was that an ice case?
No, Your Honor. It was some defect on a car. I don't think it makes any difference. It's a defect in the equipment.
So whether it's a transitory condition or not, you say it doesn't make
it? It makes absolutely no difference, Your Honor. Not a little difference.
Then would that not make the railroad an insurer?
It is. I mean, I don't know that I want to go as far as the dissent goes in the Schenker case. They're saying it's a virtual insurer. All I'm saying is, Your Honor, is that it has such an extreme duty that it may not, for example, in some circumstances, choose to inspect as often as it should, but if it doesn't, it's going to be liable. In many circumstances, railroad men are out working on premises over which the railroad has no control. They still have a duty to inspect there.
In the context of this case, where we have a standard operating procedure for the change of shifts and the train is moving at a slow speed.
Yes, sir.
Would it not require them for that practice to cease and to have a pre-flight inspection like they do in airplanes before the change crews for the plane to come to a complete stop and not only inspect the engine, but inspect all of the cars in which the brakemen are supposed to mount?
Let's not show up the facts of this case, Your Honor. The only inspection performed here, and the evidence was an inspection that was performed in Dallas, which was some 100 miles away and several hours earlier. The train pulls in slowly into Denison and has some time before it gets to the Y. All along there, a car inspector could have mounted. There was some evidence there was a car inspector seated in a vehicle nearby, but that he never got on the engine. Under the railroad rules, these employees boarded at only one place, that was at the Y, and only one part of the train, that was the engine. And the only way to get up the engine is up the sill steps, across the platform, and opening the door and getting into the cabin of the engine. So it doesn't require very long, Your Honor, I suggest, to inspect just the steps of the engine and the platform in the wintertime. Moreover, we've got conditions here that this railroad, and this is, I think, unusual, is requiring this crew to mount a moving train, and it's further unusual in that it's in the dark. That is, the overhead light is out, and the running lights on the engine are out. So here's a man trying to board.
Out as a defect, or was that standard operation?
Submitted as a part of the whole condition, an unsafe condition, Your Honor. It is a part of what should have been discovered by the railroad, but it certainly played a part, we suggest, in the man not being able to see the ice. And that's clearly with respect to what Mr. Brinson said as to whether the ice was there. As I recall the evidence, it was dark so they couldn't tell. But as soon as the sun came up, which as I recall was some 1 hour later, this happened about 5:30, in a little town, the sun comes up and everyone sees ice all over the train. Logic tells us the ice didn't get there in 1 hour. So the ice was there at the time, but it was dark and they couldn't see. I don't know whether I've answered your question or not.
The question with regards to the light not being out of the train, the jury found against you in that issue.
They did in the sense, Your Honor, there was not a... there was no issue of whether or not the light was out. There was an issue of whether or not the railroad failed to provide a safe place to work, which is the general submission of the issue. And
did you argue that the railroad provided an unsafe place to work because the light was out?
That's correct, Your Honor. What has happened here, I want to suggest to the court, is, and this is the way in which the railroad was allowed then to argue this case, is the way in which the argument was presented, is the way in which they presented it here, was just as if this railroad was Kroger Supermarket or Kmart, and it had the same kinds of duties and responsibilities. That is, just simply, did they know or should they have known of some defect? And if the jury is only told of that, we have the circumstances here. They did provide an inspection down in Dallas, and they didn't find any ice there. And no one saw any ice. It's dark. So we're in a situation where, in the Kroger supermarket case, no, Kroger doesn't know the banana peel's on the floor. But this is not a Kroger supermarket case. This is not those kinds of duties.
You're arguing that they don't have to know, or they should have had to know, about a defect.
Your Honor, we're certainly saying that foreseeability is a part, as far as stating the law, is
a
part of the law.
Are you saying what I said you're saying?
I'm not certain I am, Your Honor.
Can you answer yes or no?
I'm saying that a complete statement of the law is, if the court wants a complete statement of the law with respect to knowledge of the railroad, but not defects, yes, the railroad must have known of the defect or should have known. And the way by which they know it is they have a continuous duty to inspect. And to only give the first portion of that method of obtaining knowledge characterizes them and puts them in a situation like they are Kmart or Kroger, and they are not. And it does come a situation, as the Schenker case says, where it is like an insurer or a virtual insurer. I'm not claiming to the court that they are an insurer. We still have to prove negligence. But their duty is so severe that they have to regularly and continuously inspect. Certainly they have to inspect before men board trains.
Why doesn't the instruction that they have a continuing duty to provide a safe place of work allow you to argue that they have a continuing duty to inspect?
That's fine, Your Honor. In my experience, and I've only tried these cases for about 25 years, but in my experience, I've never seen this kind of instruction carving out just foreseeability and not giving the complete duty as to knowledge given to a jury, as this court did here. And to further say that before the jury can do anything, before you can find negligence, you've got to decide this issue.
And I mean, I gather you did argue, based on the charges actually here, you argued to the jury that they had a continuing duty to inspect.
That's correct. The point of the matter is this, Your Honor. As was said in the Accord case and the other cases like it, the mere fact that a part of what the court says here is a correct statement of the law doesn't mean it ought to be said to the jury. As Mr. Lee pointed out, even a complete statement, even had the instruction been drawn totally complete to be a complete and correct statement of the law, that also ought not to have been given to the jury. And I think I've looked at every FELA case in Texas, with Texas jurisprudence. I find not one where a foreseeability instruction is given to the jury and were objected to, it is upheld on appeal. There's a Supreme Court case called Dutton, and this court reversed because foreseeability was instructed about. There's the Standard case, which was an NRE case on the same issue. And the point is, because foreseeability relates to duty in Texas, if you're going to try a case like this in Texas, you don't instruct about foreseeability. We knew that when this court tried to do it. Therefore, we didn't request an instruction that gave the rest of the responsibilities of the railroad because we thought the whole thing was improper. That is, this kind of instruction was unnecessary and improper under Texas law.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
On page 14 of Respondent's brief, they refer to a case, Ringheiser, and there an employee was injured while using a train car as a toilet. And in their brief, they point out that the court found it was the jury's role to determine whether the railroad was or should have been aware of conditions which created a likelihood that the employee would suffer an injury such as he did. How would you distinguish that case?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any question for what I think we're trying to say this. There are some federal cases where the court seemed to be instructing the phone, some where they are and some where they are not, tried in the federal practice, on foreseeability. If the objection is made, then the complete instruction needs to be given with respect to the duty to inspect, which gives the complete duty of the railroad. But we're trying this case under state court practice, Texas practice, under Scott versus Santa Fe, a decision of this court. And the Texas practice is you don't instruct as to duty, and specifically in FELA cases, since foreseeability relates to duty, it's been held by this court that an instruction as to foreseeability should not be given. So the distinction is that this is a Texas procedural question, and under Texas procedure, an instruction like that ought not to be given. There are some federal jurisdictions where it has been given. The question was asked, I think, by Justice Spears, that, well, isn't this, this sounds like, I don't recall, Your Honor, how you said it exactly or how you asked it, but something like, well, that sounds like a proper statement of the law, so why isn't that all right, or worse to that effect? I cite the court simply to the Dixon case, which is a Fifth Circuit case where a partial statement of the law was given, and not a complete statement of the law, and that was held to be error in an FELA case. And I think that's simply what we have here, is an incomplete statement of the law, which makes it erroneous, and therefore misleads. It doesn't just nudge, it badly misleads the jury to think that this railroad is just like Kroger Supermarket.
Well, we didn't ask you, and I'm not sure you told us, what would the charge have been had you been able to write it yourself? And
it's very simple, Your Honor. We would have left the instruction.
Everything down to the last paragraph?
The rest of the instruction is pretty much boilerplate, so far as I know. I've seen the same language appears in other Texas cases, Texas Supreme Court cases. I think like Scott, I think like Dutton. But yes, Your Honor, in other words, the language that Justice Clark, that Judge Clark, Judge Reagan Clark grew up over the weekend was the last paragraph. Before negligence of any can be established against the defendant railroad, and then goes on about it. And that language we suggest should not be in the charge. And we objected to it as injecting foreseeability, as being a comment on the evidence, as being a comment on the case, as violating the whole line of cases this court has set out in far and cases after that.
So you didn't really have to submit a corrected.
We didn't think that was proper under Texas procedure, Your Honor. If we're reading the cases, we don't find any case in Texas trying an FELA case where foreseeability is ever properly instructed about if an objection is made. We don't know of one in Texas.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience is please rise.